Bell Hooks is the author of 15 books, including Killing Rage, Ain't I a Woman, and Bone Black, Memories of Girlhood. She is a distinguished professor of English at City College in New York. African-American scholar Cornel West has said of Bell Hooks' writing, "Unlike most black intellectuals, she writes with a deep sense of urgency about the existential and psychocultural dimensions of African-American life, especially those spiritual and intimate issues of love, hurt, pain, envy, and desire usually probed by artists. Her books help us not only to decolonize our minds, souls, and bodies on a deeper level, they touch our lives." This, the fifth lecture from the Big Question series, features bell hooks addressing the question, why choose love? She also tackles feminism, parenting African-American children, homophobia, sexuality, and racism in Hollywood.
I was already grappling with this one big question about love. And it's already started to happen that when I go and I talk a little bit about the question of love, people will start saying to me, "Oh, I hope you're not going to lose that, you know, critical edge, that daring, you know, like angry voice that we had in all the other writings." And I say to them that that's exactly what I think about the question of love, that to talk about love and to talk about the big question of why choose love and why our nation has to choose love again as one of the ethical values driving our daily lives is in fact to be doing that which is courageous and daring and enormously difficult to do, precisely because of the profound trivialization of love in our culture. The fact that so many people, you know, feel like that it's a soft subject. You know, talking about race and gender, now that's hard, that's provocative, that's biting. But in fact, when I wrote Yearning years ago, one of the things I said at the beginning of that book, and it's one of my favorite books, is that that space cross everything, race, sexual preference, practice. What I argued at the beginning of Yearning was that we might do well to not just problematize our difficulties around race, gender, and other things, but to also then talk about what brings us together. You know, what kinds of yearnings do we share across all of those things? And it seems to me that the desire to love and be loved is one of those yearnings people share, irrespective of class, race, sexual preference, practice, and that it might be interesting for us to theorize in terms of our struggles to end all forms of domination from that place of love. And Louise caught me at a moment when, in fact, my own thinking about this big question was in terms of thinking about the millennia, thinking about our planet, about how much we've done to end domination and how much we haven't been able to do, and to be able to think about where has love been in that discourse? Where has it been in our struggles? And I'm going to read you the preface to the new book, which I passed out little bits of it as by way of advertisement of my new little book. "When I was a child, it was clear to me that life was not worth living if we did not know love. I wish I could testify that I came to this awareness because of the love I felt in my life. But it was love's absence that let me know how much love mattered. I was my father's first daughter. At the moment of my birth, I was looked upon with loving kindness, cherished, and made to feel wanted in this earth and on my home. And in my home. To this day, I can't remember when that feeling of being loved left me. I just know that one day I was no longer precious. Those who had loved me well initially turned away. The absence of their recognition and regard pierced my heart and left me with a feeling of brokenheartedness so profound I was spellbound. Grief and sadness overwhelmed me. I didn't know what I had done wrong, and nothing I tried made it right. No other connection healed the hurt of that first abandonment, that first banishment from love's paradise. For years, I lived my life suspended, trapped by the past, unable to move into the future. Like every wounded child, I just wanted to turn back time and be in that paradise again, in that moment of remembered rapture where I felt loved, where I felt a sense of belonging. We can never go back. I know that now. We can go forward. We can find the heart, the love our hearts long for, but not until we let go grief about the love we lost long ago when we were little and had no voice to speak the heart's learning. All the years of my life, I thought I was searching for love. I found retrospectively to be years where I was simply trying to recover what I had lost, trying to return to the first home, to get back the rapture of first love. I was not really ready to be loved in the present. I was still mourning, clinging to the broken heart of girlhood, to broken connections. When that mourning ceased, I was able to love again. And I talk about this because my reentry into the world of searching for love and talking to people about love really raised again that big question of why choose love. Because as I began to talk to people about love, so many people said to me, "Oh, girl, you're not interested in love." My sister said, "Oh, you don't want a husband, girl. If you had one, you'd be trying to get rid of him like we're trying to do with the ones we have." You know? But the deepest thing for me was when I talked to young people, and particularly I marked my interview with the little porn rapper, Lil' Kim, as a turning point for me in thinking about love, because we had been talking about, you know, rap and all the different things, and at one point I said to her, "What about love?" And then this is a few years ago, and she said to me, "Love, what's that? I've never known any love." And suddenly it just hit me that here was a nation where this young black woman could come from a dysfunctional, poor family, and she could aspire to be a multimillionaire before the age of 30 and potentially reach that goal. But she could have no sense that within her life she might know love, that she might have a sense of what love is, and therefore, as you know, if she doesn't know love, then she's not going to be able to give love to others. And so this really, really, really moved me deep in my heart. I felt such a sense of sorrow. But as always, I theorized from the personal into the collective. I thought, well, what does it mean to live in a nation that can make it possible, despite racism, despite sexism, despite class oppression, for poor young people to play basketball and become multimillionaires before they're, you know, the age of 40, to do certain forms of music and become multimillionaires, but that culture still does not make a place where those people can begin to know love. And I think that one of the profound brilliances of Gloria Steinem's books, Revolution from Within, was that she pointed out that when you raise a nation of successful people who are still mired in self-hatred, those powerful and successful people, though they may have money and success, may also do grave harm to people, the people they work with, the planet, etc., because underneath all of those trappings is that wounded voice saying, "Love, what's that? I don't know anything about love." In Terry's book, and I thank Terry for introducing me, and I urge you, if you don't know her work, to read it, but also the collections of writings about AIDS, there's a marvelous introduction that she writes where she says in one paragraph there that we never imagined love would be like this. And in many ways, in my own writing about love, I've tried to get at that reimagination of love, a vision of love that might take us from that sense of the love that hurts, the love that does not ensure our survival, or the love that does not ensure that we can die recognized, known. You know, every day in our life, people are dying of AIDS somewhere whose family refused to recognize them, who refused to honor their life with the acknowledgement of their worth and their value. I want to just read a little bit, and then we have lots of time for questions. This is a piece that I wanted to work on in terms of thinking about the relationship between why choose love and human community. And part of what I want to theorize with you today is when we do not choose love, it does not change the fact that our existence on this planet is one of interdependency. I had the marvelous occasion a few weeks ago to interview Thich Nhat Hanh, the Buddhist teacher who's affected my work so much. And one of the things that we talked about was this question of how to interest people in choosing love and in interdependency in a world where we can't get away from our interdependency and our interconnectedness. At the same time, what we spend so much of our time doing is violating that interdependency and that interconnectedness. To ensure human survival, everywhere in the world, females and males organize themselves into communities. Communities sustain life. This is my answer to the question of why choose love. Communities sustain life, not nuclear families, not the couple, and certainly not the rugged individualists. There is no better place to learn the art of loving than in community. M. Scott Peck begins his book, A Different Drum, Community Making and Peace, with the profound declaration, in and through community lies the salvation of the world. Peck defines community as the coming together of a group of individuals, quote, who have learned how to communicate honestly with each other, whose relationships go deeper than their mask of composure, and who have developed some significant commitment to rejoice together, mourn together, and to delight in each other, and make other conditions our own. I think that's such a beautiful description of community. We're all born into the world of community. Rarely, if ever, does a child come into the world in isolation with only one or two onlookers. There are usually other witnesses present, people whom we are connected to by blood and kinship, as well as strangers. Children are born into the world surrounded by the possibility of communities. Families, doctors, nurses, midwives, and even admiring strangers make up this field of connections, some more intimate than others. Much of the talk about family values in our society highlights the nuclear family, one that's made up of mother, father, and preferably only one or two children. In the United States, this unit is presented as the primary and preferable organization for the parenting of children, one that will ensure everyone's optimal well-being. Of course, everyone knows this is a fantasy image of family. Hardly anyone in our society lives in an environment like this. Even individuals who are raised in nuclear families usually experience it as merely a smaller unit within a larger unit of extended kin. And I go on in these pages to talk about the failure of the patriarchal nuclear family to teach us how to choose love. And then I say here, the privatized patriarchal nuclear family is still a fairly new form of social organization in the world. Given the world's swiftly dwindling resources, the vast majority of people do not have, and will never have, the material resources to live segregated from family communities into small units. Even in the United States, studies show that economic factors, the high cost of housing and unemployment, are creating a cultural climate where grown children are leaving the family home at a later stage and frequently returning or never leaving. I remember, like my own mother and father, like we rented this old rambling house, and when we were all gone, they bought this little two-bedroom tiny house that they thought they were going to retire and have this peaceful life in. And at every step of the way, there has been some child or some grandchild or a whole combination of people there in that house with them because of, one, economic circumstances. Second, the ravages of addiction where people lose complete control over their lives. The extended family is a good place to learn the power of community. However, it can only become a community if there's honest combination between individuals who comprise that family. If we don't experience love in our extended families of origins, which is the first site for community offered us, the other place where children have the opportunity to build community and know love is in friendship. Since we choose our friends, many of us from childhood on into our adulthood, we look to friends for the care, respect, knowledge, and all-around nurturance of our growth we don't find in families. Writing in her moving memoir, Never Let Me Down, Susan Miller recalls, "I kept thinking, love must be here somewhere. I looked and looked inside myself, but I couldn't find it. I knew what love was. It was the feeling I had with my dolls, for beautiful things, for certain friends. Later on, when I knew Debbie, my best friend, I felt even more sure that love was what made you feel good. Love was not what made you feel bad, hate yourself. It was what comforted you, freed you up inside, made you laugh. Sometimes Debbie and I would fight, but that was different because we were basically, essentially connected. Loving friendships provide a space for us to experience the joy of community in a relationship where we learn to process, to cope with differences and conflict while staying connected." And I go on in this particular writing to talk about how often the myth of romantic love as being the only love that matters leads many of us to portray the power of love in friendship. And I give examples of this, but most importantly, I say trust is the heartbeat of genuine love. And we trust that the attention we give to partners and that we give to friends does not take anything away from us, that we're not diminished. What we learn through experience is that their capacity to establish deep and profound bonds and connections in friendship strengthens all intimate bonds. When we see love as the will to nurture one's own or another's spiritual growth, revealed through acts of trust, care, respect, knowing, and assuming responsibility, the foundation of all love in our life is the same. There's no special love reserved for romantic partners. Genuine love is the foundation of our engagement with ourselves, with family, with friends, with partners, with everyone we choose to love. Here then I talk again about this privileging of romantic relationships and how part of the sort of what I call new visions that I'm trying to explore in my discussions of love is what would it mean for us as a culture to no longer raise romantic love as the only relevant love? And to begin to talk about the fact that indeed what makes love work with your child, with anyone in your life, is the same foundation that is needed in romantic relationships within a loving community. We sustain ties by being compassionate and forgiving. Eric Butterworth's Life is for Loving includes a chapter on love and forgiveness. Insightfully, he writes, "We can't endure without love, and there's no way to the return of healing, comforting, harmonizing love than through total and complete forgiveness. If we want freedom and peace and the experience of love and being loved, we must let go and forgive. Forgiveness is an act of generosity. It requires that we place releasing someone else from the prison of their guilt or anguish over our feelings of outrage or anger. By forgiving, we clear a path on the way to love. It's a gesture of respect. True forgiveness requires that we understand the negative actions of another. While forgiveness is essential to spiritual growth, it doesn't make everything immediately wonderful or fine." I talked in this piece, and Mario, who came up to me earlier as a student here in California, and he said to me that he had read the really vicious critique of my work that, who had been my one-time friend and comrade, Michelle Wallace, wrote about me a few years ago in The Voice. And when this particular piece came out, I had just recently lost my dear friend, the poet Essex Hemphill, to AIDS, and before him, Marlon Riggs, the filmmaker. And when I heard that this piece was so trashing, I felt that I didn't want to read it. And I was so struck by the number of people who were pissed off with me that I didn't want to read it. And they kept calling me up and they said, you know, this person is ruining your career. You've got to read this. And I was like, no, I mean, why do I want to take in this toxicity? This is someone whose work I love. This is someone that I think is an especially insightful feminist thinker. And this is where Buddhism is often helpful. I knew that if I read this writing, it would penetrate my ego, and that instead of, when I heard this person's name, instead of thinking about what an insightful writer she is, I would be thinking about, oh, that bitch that wrote that really, you know, horrible piece about me. And I actually wanted not to enter that space. And we have not spoken to each other for many years since that piece. And she called me just a few weeks ago to say to me that she wanted to say to me that she was sorry that she had written that piece, that she knew that it was not a just piece of writing. And I was very moved by this. And I told people about it, and a lot of people said, oh, who cares about her calling you? She wrote that piece for all the world to hear and see. If she wants real, you know, forgiveness, she should publish something. And, you know, I, of course, would be delighted if she published something because she did write that piece to the world. But at the same time, I was deeply moved by the fact that she called me and acknowledged and made amends, because I feel that forgiveness is important. And I say here, her critiques were full of lies and exaggerations. I had been a loving friend, and her actions caused me heartbreak. To heal this pain, I entered into an empathic identification with her so I could understand what might have motivated her. Through the practice of compassion and forgiveness, I was able to sustain my appreciation for her work and cope with the grief and disappointment I felt about the loss of this relationship. Practicing compassion enabled me to understand why she might have acted as she did and to forgive. Forgiving means that I'm able to see her as still a member of my community, one who has a place in my heart should she wish to claim it. We all long for loving community. It enhances life. But many of us seek community solely to escape the fear of being alone. Knowing how to be solitary is central to the art of loving. When we can be alone, we can be with others without using them as a means of escape.